Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking today about social media and the challenge of all these new technologies for the Christian church. You know, standing here in the year 2010, is it not amazing how this is now taken for granted around us? The digital revolution has been so sudden and yet so pervasive that we literally now order our lives around Twitter and Facebook and blogs and email and texting and all the rest. The question is, at what cost? How should Christians think about this? I participated in a very important pre-conference held at Orlando by Ligonier Ministries. And even as I was speaking at their national conference on Thursday, we really got together to talk about what it means for Christians to encounter social media. One of my colleagues there, a fellow participant in this forum, was Tim Challies, a very prominent Christian blogger. And you'll find his work at challies.com. Many of you know of him already. His site is one of those must-visit sites, just in terms of the evangelical world. But he's going to be joining me as a guest in just a moment. We're going to be talking about the impact of social media, the challenge. What are the advantages? What are the dangers? How should we think it through? That'll be upcoming in just a few moments. First of all, I'll review some other things in the news. I don't know if you caught this column by Maureen Dowd, but I'll tell you the truth. In the New York Times, I almost turn first to Maureen Dowd's column whenever I see she has one on the op-ed page of the New York Times, because it's always going to be thoughtful. I may disagree with it. As a matter of fact, she comes from the left, and I'll tell you, I disagree with her probably, the majority of the time. But even when I disagree with her, she makes me think. And she wrote a book entitled something about the end of males, or Are Men Necessary? That was the title of her book. And I happened to be at a book signing. I was at the Borders Bookstore in downtown Washington, D.C. when she was doing a signing. I went up to her and just handed her the book. And bless her heart, she recognized me. And she wrote an inscription to one man who is necessary. So it was nice to have Maureen Dowd affirm that I was necessary. But nonetheless, in a column that she wrote in the New York Times just a few days ago entitled Their Dangerous Swagger, she writes about boys, in this case, soon-to-be freshman boys at Landon, an elite private grade school and high school for boys in wealthy Washington, D.C. suburb of Montgomery County, Maryland. These boys, who I guess were, it must be in ages 13 or 14, if they're rising to freshman year in high school in the fall, they were preying on girls. They were rating them by their sexual attributes and physical attributes. And let me just tell you, the language used in this is something that I really can't communicate adequately over the air, but unfortunately, you probably have a pretty good idea of what I'm talking about here. Now, the reason why Maureen Dowd wrote this article was because in the background to all of this is the murder of a lacrosse player at the University of Virginia. And this particular lacrosse player, Yardley Love, was killed by her boyfriend, George Hughley V, who happened to be a former student at Landon, the very school in which these boys were caught in this kind of predatory behavior. She talks about their swagger, these athletes. She says it was set up like a fantasy football league draft. The height, weight, and performance statistics of the draftees were offered to decide who would make the cut and who would emerge as the number one pick. But the players in this predatory game were not famous NFL stars. They were unwitting girls about to start high school. And so Maureen Dowd has a very legitimate concern, a feminist concern that is very legitimate, about the exploitation of these girls and about this kind of athletic culture among boys that is winked at by parents, is basically overlooked by school administrators, and is fostered even in some settings, which has led to the kind of controversy that has emerged around the sport of lacrosse in colleges, and especially the kind of role of the rogue male now. And what she's writing about is the fact that this doesn't start when they're 19 or 20. It's going back, obviously, as these boys were caught in this activity, to boys at ages 12, 13, 14, 15, and far earlier. And when she talks about their dangerous swagger, well, she writes about the fact they're really not held to account. She talks about the fact that the code of character of the Landon School says that they are to be part of a true brotherhood. It boasts about the Landon Civility Code. Boys are expected to work together to eliminate all forms of disrespect and to respect one another in our surroundings and our decorum, appearance, and interactions. Clearly, that is not happening. And by the way, these Landon sex teams, as she refers to them, that were put together by these boys, it did not lead to a very serious sanction against them. The school's director of communications said she was aware of the incident, but that student records, including disciplinary infractions, are confidential. She bragged about the school's extensive ethics and character education program. And yet, as Maureen Dowd says, it's time for a curriculum overhaul. Young men everywhere must be taught beyond platitudes that young women are not prey. Okay, now this is where I want to say, every once in a while, and this is important for Christians to recognize, every once in a while, a feminist like Maureen Dowd can bring a very legitimate issue to the table. And she's calling here for a revision of the curriculum and for boys to be taught that these things are wrong. I'm going to suggest to you that Christians had better look at the same development and understand that something more than a curricular revision is going to be necessary. What you have here is a lawlessness, a lustful lawlessness, that is spawned among young adolescent boys by a culture that is so hypersexualized and worships athletes to such an extent that what they are doing here is what they perceive is being done by older men who are their sports heroes and is actually winked at and appreciated by older men who will give at worst a smirk and perhaps a mild reprimand. Where is there the concern here that we have created a culture in which this is not only plausible at an elite school for boys like this, but had better be expected? It better be expected that this kind of behavior is what boys are going to see as their rightful, right in the world, because after all, they see it in the athletes who are older. They may see it in their own fathers. They see it in a culture which is driven by pornography and the exploitation of women. The problem I have with where Maureen Dowd ends this article is that she calls for a curricular revision to teach these boys that this just is not right. I'm going to suggest to you that we need a revision of the entire culture. And this is where Christian parents have better understand and Christian churches have better understand. We have to create a counterculture to this. We have to create a counterweight, not just on whether it is right to rate girls sexually and put up a website in which you draft girls for your own sexual fantasies, but rather we say to boys, you were created for something better than this. Women were created as God's gifts in a very different way than this portrays. And what we see here is not just the collapse of decorum and ethics among grade school boys in a wealthy suburb of Virginia. We're seeing what we are spawning as a civilization that worships sex and worships athletics and winks when there are indiscretions and just horrific immoral actions and basically never holds anyone to account. You know, it's not that these boys are not listening to the adult culture. I'm afraid what this betrays is that they actually are. Now, on a very similar theme, there's something interesting that emerged from Smart Money Magazine. You don't necessarily look for big moral insights from a magazine called Smart Money Magazine. It's not a journal of ethics, but it is making an ethical point. In a cover story on the rising cost of a midlife crisis, and this is coming from the July 2010 issue of Smart Money Magazine, it's talking not only about the rising cost in a recession of deciding to jump out of airplanes or buy a Harley Davidson or engage in any number of the kinds of activities that kind of cartoonishly are expected of men, especially in a midlife crisis. Unexpectedly in this article, it raises this particular issue. It says that if you want to have a good financial outcome, after all, this is Smart Money Magazine, you need to keep your spouse on your side. It points out that the cost of having a midlife affair, that is, committing adultery as a part of your midlife crisis, is rising. The columnist writes, meanwhile, the price of dumping your spouse for a midlife affair is only rising. Divorce attorneys say that stay-at-home spouses who raise kids, for example, may be entitled to as much as 70% of joint assets. Interesting argument, isn't it? To emerge from a financial magazine, encouraging people to take care of their financial future and demonstrating that having an affair, committing adultery, really isn't very good for your financial future. You know, I find it rather sad that that's the limitation of the moral insight that's offered here. But after all, this is a magazine about money. But is it not interesting that in the economy, even in a man's personal finances, you find a barometer of his soul? And when you find something like adultery, well, here's a magazine saying, look, buddy, it's going to come with a financial cost. If only it were that cheap. It comes with a far deeper cost, something no amount of money can cover. And I wonder how many men who have contemplated an affair, I wonder how many of them will be stopped more by the fear of what it would cost them in terms of their bank account than in terms of their soul. Maybe some of the same fathers of the boys we just heard about in that Landon school and that controversy. Back to talk about social media. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're going to be talking about social media, the digital revolution, and what this represents as a challenge for Christians. And it's a huge challenge. We're going to be talking today, at least in part, about the scale of that challenge. And I'm glad to welcome to the program today Tim Challies, who is a well-known Christian blogger and really a good authority in this area. You'll find his work at Challies at Challies.com. And Tim and I were recently at the Ligonier Ministries National Conference. We did a pre-conference together on social media and the challenge this represents to the church. And I'm glad to welcome Tim Challies to the program today. Tim, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I'm glad it's worked out for you to be on the program today. Let's just kind of go over what we're talking about here and talk about that pre-conference we enjoyed doing together at Ligonier. You know, why would a conference like that be important to talk about social media here in the year 2010?
Well, social media has kind of taken over, hasn't it? It's come on the scene just in the last few years, kind of a natural extension of what the Internet has become. There was a day when certain people produce content on the web and everyone else digested it, so CNN would go ahead and write a news story and everyone else would read it. But that kind of changed with the advent of blogs and the advent of social media. So now we have all become the content creators, and I think that's represented just a massive shift in news, in entertainment, in just about every field, analysis of the news. And I think we're just at the very beginning of something entirely new now.
Yeah, you know, I was reading an article in which a major figure with NPR, National Public Radio, was interviewed just in recent days in the Wall Street Journal. And she made the point that the arrival of social media, digital technology, blogs and all the rest is now reached the point where if you want to reach a younger generation, you start there. You don't end there. You start there because that's where they are. And that represents something new for us. You know, I think there are a lot of people listening to this program, especially on broadcast radio, who are going to say, you know, I don't think social media is that big a part of my life. I think, number one, maybe you got the definition wrong. It's probably a bigger part of your life than you think. But secondly, if you've got children or grandchildren, I guarantee you, it's a big part of their lives.
It absolutely is a big part of their lives. And I think, well, one of Neil Postman's truisms about technology is that technology always shifts authority, it shifts power. And I think we see that very clearly in the social media revolution and this digital revolution, as the power is very quickly shifting to those who are engaging in social media away from those who do not. So you're right, if you want to reach the younger generation, you absolutely need to get the social media correct. And if you want to ask someone about that, ask John McCain. The Obama campaign in 2008 absolutely nailed social media. The McCain campaign really, really dropped the ball on that, and that put a huge number of voters in the Democratic camp.
You know, that's another interesting point, Tim, because there have been recent analyses done by political analysts in recent days demonstrating that even though the Obama campaign, as you said, really mobilized young adults and exploited social media in a very brilliant way, as they were running for office, the White House seems to be having a hard time knowing once you're president exactly what you do with social media.
Yeah, and isn't that the case? The very same forces that mobilize the people are the very same forces that will turn against you. And if forces can be turned so quickly against one person, well, they can be quickly turned against you in the end as well. And I think Obama's starting to see some of that, where the campaign, or where just people have turned against him a little bit, and the same kind of buzz that can get going for you can very quickly get going against you as well.
Now, when you were speaking in Orlando at the Ligonier Conference, what were you trying to get across? What were your main points?
Yeah, I was asked to speak about conduct in communications. What I was really trying to focus on was talking to Christians about the responsibility we have to use this new, these new platforms, this new kind of social media. And so my exhortation to them was to speak truth and to speak truth in love. So to use these platforms and to use them well, but to make sure that we're always using them in love. So we're encouraging one another, we're building up instead of tearing down.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And as I'm kind of pushing back a little bit, I'd say, Tim, you would basically say that we bear the same kind of moral responsibility for every form of communication, right?
I would think so, yeah. If a new form of communication comes across, I think we as Christians need to be quick to ascertain whether there's real value in it and then use it. And I know we're all grateful recipients of the legacy left by the printing press. And if Christians hadn't been so quick to jump on that, the Reformation certainly would have looked a lot different if it could have happened at all. So absolutely, when a new technology comes along, a new form of communication, we need to be involved in it, or at least be willing to become involved in it if we determine that it's useful and wise.
Yeah, I think one of the points I would want to make here is that there are people who seem to think that morally speaking, communicating in social or digital media is somehow different than what it would mean to talk face to face. And I think Christians ought to be the first to spot, hey, we have a problem here. We've got a category error. If we have people who think they have license to speak one way, say, online, and a different way in person.
Right, and one of the things I said in my talk was that when we talk about a verse like in Ephesians where it talks about speaking truth in love, really the word speaking isn't there at all. It just says truthing in love. And so we're to communicate truth no matter how we can communicate it, whether that's through typing or through writing books or through speaking. In all ways we can communicate truth, God calls us to do just that.
Okay, so let's talk about the opportunity side of this, because that's huge. What is the opportunity that we don't want Christians to miss with the arrival of this new technology?
Well, probably foremost is that this is the way people communicate today, and more young people especially, but it's creeping over all of society. This is the way people get their news and their information. This is the way people engage and interact with one another. You've probably heard that the fastest growing segment on Facebook now is women in their 50s. And so people of all ages, of all kinds, are jumping onto these social media platforms, and that's how they're interacting. And if that's where people are not only getting their information, but also then digesting it and interacting with others, discussing it, I think Christians really have a responsibility to be there and to be engaging in these ways, making sure that we're not just following behind, but we're actually leading conversations.
Yeah, a great deal of the cultural conversation has shifted there that used to be elsewhere. You know, Tim, I'm holding in my hands a rather remarkable piece of paper. And it is a page from the Wall Street Journal from several years ago, the year 2005. And what we have here is an article about it's introducing the readers of the Wall Street Journal to a man by the name of Mark Zuckerberg and a product called Facebook. And as a matter of fact, they call it thefacebook.com.
Right.
In its earliest, form, it's a fascinating thing because I'm looking at this and I'm holding in my hands literally the article that was used in the Wall Street Journal of all things, the main organ of American business, to say here's something that just might be important.
Yeah, I think they got that one right. It's very interesting to look at the dawn of Facebook, the Facebook, to see where it came from. And as people talk today about some of the security concerns and other concerns with Facebook, you only have to look as far as Mark Zuckerberg to see that really he's a bit of an interesting character and honestly a bit of a punk, a guy that you really wouldn't want to entrust much information to. And Facebook came about, he essentially stole the idea and built it up from there. So it's very interesting to see how that came about and how it's grown so big. I just got back from vacation and got a Canadian business magazine, and there's Mark on the front cover of that as well. So he's everywhere, and his platform, his profile has just grown exponentially.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the data about Facebook is fairly mind-boggling. The number of registered users worldwide is now well over 400 million, and at least one source at Facebook is saying that it's probably now over 500 million. 75% of those users, by the way, are outside of the United States. And in a recent profile of the company, it's interesting to see that the ambitions of Facebook, like the ambitions of Google and many others of these technological companies driving innovation, is to move more and more of the culture's attention and conversation onto their platform. We now have competition between old digital media, of all things, and new digital media. After all, one of the main competitors right now for attention to Facebook is something that didn't even exist 3 years ago called Twitter. We'll be right back with more on the Albert Miller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about the challenge that is represented by social media in the church today. And this is something that really compels the attention of Christians. Far too many Christians have simply just kind of put their brains into neutral and have just accepted all these developments as something that just comes at us like a cultural tsunami and have just kind of let them wash over us. And the one thing that we talk about in the next segment is the toll that takes on our children and many of those people we love, the risks that are entailed with that. But I do not want to deny the gains. I mean, after all, I put a great deal of work into my website at albertmohler.com. This program is heard over broadcast radio, but many people also hear it over the internet by podcast and webcast, and that's just the way it's going. An interview with one of the major figures at NPR this recent week said that they are agnostic now at NPR, a very interesting word used there. And this is spoken by Vivian Schiller, the chief executive officer of NPR. She said, "We are agnostic about whether someone listens over broadcast or listens to the exact same radio stream on the internet." Well, she can be agnostic at NPR because their revenue doesn't depend on it. But the reality is that what we have is a tremendous amount now of competition, both generationally and culturally, between old and new media. One of the men who's best equipped, I think, to speak about this from a Christian perspective is Tim Challies. He's our guest today on this program. He is a web designer and with a degree in history, by the way, from McMaster University in Canada. And he does a great deal of work on his website at challies.com. And as a matter of fact, his website's become kind of a must-go-to destination for those trying to find out what's going on in the evangelical world. Tim, how in the world did that get started? Did you, when you were a little Tim Challies, did you hope to grow up one day to be a blogger?
No, not at all. I started the website in 2002. My parents had just moved from Toronto. I live up here in Canada. They just moved down to the Atlanta area, and I had a couple of kids and thought it would be fun to post some photos of the kids on the web for my parents. So I got the family name, Challies.com, and started putting pictures of the kids up there. But I got it in my head a couple times to write some articles and put them on the blog as well to let my folks read them. And Google and other search engines, I guess Alta Vista or whoever existed back then, they picked up the articles, and then people started searching for them and finding them and reading them and seemed to enjoy them. So I took down the pictures of the kids and started the writing. And that's kind of the genesis of the site. And then it's grown maybe through leaps, through some big cultural or Christian cultural things like The Passion of the Christ or Purpose-Driven Life, the book The Shack, just as things like that have come along. I've seen a big growth in traffic.
Yeah.
I've done reviews or interacted with those things.
You know, it's really interesting because when I began my website, it was just all words and writing. And you know, I had to learn along the way what was necessary in terms of some visual input as well. So it's interesting how this comes about. But the blogosphere has become a very now not just ancillary but dominant part of our cultural conversation. Bloggers have prime seats at news events. Now, did you see that coming?
No, not at all. I suppose it makes sense. But I think increasingly we're seeing a pretty fine line between blogging and news. A lot of the big gadget sites, a lot of the big political sites, those are where the biggest bloggers tend to live. Some of those, it's almost indistinguishable whether it's real news or real blogging. They may not come from a Fox News or a CNN kind of perspective, but it's still, there's quite a fine line. So there does seem to be some blurring, and of course every media outlet has its own blog. So yeah, it seems like there's a lot of blurring going on, fewer distinctions than before.
Now let me ask you two questions that I'd really love to hear you answer, and I'm going to give them both to you right up front so you know what they are. Number one, what is the greatest kind of advantage and opportunity that comes to us through social media and digital technology? And secondly, what do you see as the greatest danger for Christians?
I think the greatest advantage is that it can collect people of like minds. And we talked today about the new Calvinism or the young, restless, reformed resurgence of theology. And those are very good things. And they've been carried, really, by social media, I think. I don't see how they could have happened without it, because that was really what tied them together, certain blogs, certain websites. And now Facebook and other things have really carried that sort of movement. And yet I think that's also the biggest danger. What's made such a success also brings danger in that we can become very insular, we can become very attached to ourselves and refuse to look outside. So one of the big things about social media is allowing us to craft our own experience, so we can make it whatever we want it to be. We can take our Facebook page and make it how we want it. We can take our blog and make it how we want it. So I think there's a danger there that we refuse to look outside very small boundaries.
Very good words. And Tim Challies, you can find his work and his main blog and website at www.challies.com. I want to thank Tim Challies for being my guest, but in many ways for being kind of the first draft of history and of reporting developments, and just for doing things like live blogging the Ligonier Conference, because, quite frankly, that's one of the main and most important and effective ways of getting the word out these days. You want to go to his site at www.challies.com. We'll be back with more. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I mentioned being with Tim Challies at the Ligonier Ministries National Conference. We did a pre-conference together on social media and what it really represents as a challenge to the church. I was speaking about the hyper-socialized generation, and they asked me to do that based upon an article that I had written some time back. I didn't invent that word, hyper-socialized. That came from a reporter talking about the phenomenon of the coming generation being socially related almost every hour of the day. I didn't just say waking hour, just every hour of the day. And it just so happened that as I was getting ready to give this address, the New York Times came along with a little assist to me with a front page story from June 7th. That's just, you know, a matter of about 2 weeks ago, entitled Hooked on Gadgets and Paying a Mental Price. It is about the Campbell family, a suburban San Francisco, California. Cord Campbell, the father, is so dominated by the electronic machines and social media that he has at instant availability that he's disconnected from his family and admits he's disconnected from his family. Has a hard time even carrying on a conversation with his family. Their 16-year-old son, 8-year-old daughter are following pretty much in line, and now mom as well. It's a picture of the tremendous mental price that is brought about by the overuse of digital media, the saturation of our minds and lives in digital media. It's a reminder there's a tremendous moral dimension to this, because God made us relational creatures primarily so that we can relate to Him. And then when it comes secondarily to our fellow human beings, we need to be spending most of our time and attention being related to those who are there with us, in particular family, wife, husband, children, and friends and colleagues. And we all know how this new phenomenon of social media can pull that apart. Now, one of the things I want to avoid is making this an either or, all or nothing kind of question, because we're not going to reverse this technological revolution. That's not going to happen. And so as you've got teenagers or children in the house, just understand that, you know, they're going to be living in a social media world the rest of their lives. What we want to do is try to help them think carefully and clearly about this. And as you know, in this program, time and time again, I come back to the fact that parents have to establish boundaries. And I just want to remind you of some things I talked about at this meeting, where this pre-conference down in Orlando, because if you do not know these things, you need to know. I mean, we're talking right now about an enormous number of young people sending hundreds, indeed thousands, of texts, sending and receiving them on a monthly basis. The average teenager is sending 2,272 text messages a month. Just add that up. The figures are actually daunting. They almost boggle the mind. They are almost, it seems, unbelievable when you start thinking about what's going on. And these teenagers, by the way, and they are as young as about 12 on average, and as old as college students, many of them literally feel a tremendous anxiety when pulled away from constant input and output from these digital devices. There are an enormous number of teenagers who sleep with the cell phone on the pillow so they can be awakened if a friend sends them a text message in the night. There are kids who, even as they are being sent to the principal's office or violating rules by texting during class, are texting about their discipline. That's the story told by one reporter that I wrote about at my website. And then there's more than this. Get this, just the numbers here. 1 in 3 teenagers sends more than 100 text messages a day. That's more than 3,000 a month. Daily text messaging by friends to friends among teenagers has increased so much since the year 2008 that back then only 38% of teens said they were daily texters, and now it's almost all of them, 87%. Half of all teens send 50 or more text messages a day. 15% send more than 200 a day. Now get this, you're going to know this difference is coming, right? Boys typically send and receive 30 texts a day. Girls typically send and receive 80 text messages per day. So it turns out that not only do they have more words to speak, they have more words to text or to tweet or to send by Facebook as well. But that number was just for text messaging. The hyper-socialized generation is a generation that has become so accustomed to this kind of immersion in digital data that, as one specialist said, they're basically looking at this as the air they breathe. When you say you don't have to be connected, it is to them almost like saying you don't have to breathe. At the conference, let me tell you some of the things that I really felt were important to say. Number one, the digitally consumed soul is a horribly spiritually distracted soul. There's no doubt that our Christian lives require some periods of silence, the kind of contemplation that it takes to grow up to be a maturing Christian, the kind of concentration it takes for authentic prayer. These things require silence. We need to rid ourselves of the distractions of external things. It used to be to say, you'd say to people, you know, turn off the television, you know, or put down the video game. But now the challenge of digital media goes far beyond that. And this hyper-socialized generation thinks that it's a generation that can read the Bible and bend the knee in worship and pray and text simultaneously. Text about praying as much as they text about being in trouble at the principal's office for texting. It's one of those things that has so swept over us like a flood that it's almost impossible to take the full account of what it represents. I'll tell you what else is failing. This massive study done by the Kaiser Family Foundation that found that these kids are cramming 11 hours of digital content into 7.5 hours of the waking day. It also discovered that the one thing they are not doing that previous generations of teenagers and young adults used to do is read. And one of the things, without apology, I want to emphasize is that Christians are quite understandably people who are invested in reading, because literacy, for no accident, has been a very important part of Christian responsibility, because God spoke to us in an inscripturated or a written revelation. And thus, reading is a part of our Christian discipleship. And, of course, that starts with the reading of Scripture. But beyond that, we come to know that maturing Christians, indeed well-rounded, well-educated, thoughtful Christian adults, are people who read a great deal. And so look at this statistic. You have Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com speaking about the Kindle, his electronic ebook device, saying that they're marketing that only to serious reading households. That is, households that actually might read a book on an annual basis or something similar to that. And he estimated that that represents, at best, no more than 10% of the American population. Then we have a study coming down from the American Libraries Association saying that the average college graduate, you get this, not college dropout, not someone who didn't go to college, the average college graduate doesn't read a nonfiction book cover to cover after they graduate. And that tells us that we are reaching a post-literate age. And one of the downsides of this hyper-socialized generation is that in all their thumbing and tweeting and texting, they're not reading. There is little silence in their lives. You know, one of the things that's coming in from the research is that multitasking basically is a lie we tell ourselves. I'll be talking more about that when we come back with final thoughts on the Albert Miller Program. It's been good to have this conversation. I enjoyed the conversation with Tim Challies, and I hope this is prompting some conversations in homes across America, especially those of you who are Christian parents and Christian young people, and you're considering this. It needs to be a matter of our accountability. You know, it's not like social media is some kind of birthright. It is a technology to be reconsidered, just like everything else we do. And again, I am not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater. You will find me on Facebook. You will find me on Twitter. You will find me on the internet. You will find my website at albertmoeller.com. If you look in my briefcase, you're going to find a Kindle and an iPad and a laptop, because I am just in the course of doing my business. Did I mention the iPhone? I mean, it's all there. And the iPod, it's all there, because they are the tools of getting the job done in this digital age. They can be a great distraction. They can be an amazingly positive thing. I have connected with people that I would never have known before. I've had Christians and persons who want to know more about Christianity write me and contact me from nations all over the world. There are people listening to this program and are able to communicate back to me, even send questions for Ask Anything Wednesday from all over the world. And that's an amazing thing. There are grandmothers and grandfathers actually able to keep up with their grandchildren's lives through Facebook, when otherwise they didn't know. They can look at the pictures. They can find out. Maybe they'll find something that'll scare them to death. But that's the reality. In this hyper-socialized generation, there are many exposures. There is much risk. And, of course, morally, we've got the phenomenon of many people thinking that their online life somehow is run according to different rules than the rest of their life. I mentioned multitasking. One of the things that's coming in from the cognitive research is that multitasking is a charade. It really doesn't work as we think it works. And one of the great costs to us is the cost of attentiveness. And so I just want to encourage you to think about that and the cost of all these things. You know, let me tell you one of the things that I have done in my life. I am a man who loves books. If you know me, you know my library, which is a pretty sizable place, just in terms of my study, is a very important place for me. But I also have to do so much work on the computer. So I've got my writing desk, and I've got the computer there, I've got the keyboard there, and all the rest. But I've had to put my reading chair in a place where there are no screens to see, there are no keyboards to touch, because the act of reading is something that I need to devote myself to, as well as the act of writing, apart from access and the demands of these things. Because I'll tell you the way it works, you know how it works. If that computer screen is there, and it just might be that someone's tried to tell you something, you feel like you got to go look at it and find out. Well, every once in a while, you just need to say to everybody, hey, I got more important things to do. I'm going to go have coffee with someone and share the gospel. I'm going to spend time with a kid who just needs a little bit of time. That means FaceTime. I'm going to read a book. I'm going to write somebody a letter. Can you imagine that? There are people going to scratch their heads and say, I remember that. What exactly does that look like? Let's be good stewards of this technology.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.